might remember that last November, MSU put out a call to people with ties to the university to submit video of what they were doing on a particular day. It was November 6th. The idea was to get a view of the world through the eyes of as many Spartans as possible. Quick note that the finished product goes online today. It's called MSU 360-24. The Big Ten Network will also air this. And Scott Pohl joins us a little bit later on this hour to also tell us more about MSU 360-24. Its current state here on WKAR and what's been the coldest January since 1977 for many places in Michigan is just about behind us. What a shame to see it almost in the rearview mirror. To review and update some of this frigid month's top Michigan news stories, current state welcomes Tim Skubick, host of Michigan Public TV's Off the Record. T.S., good to see you.
I was sleeping on that date.
Okay. That was a whole month. Oh, on November 6th.
Yes,
I see what
you
you're
go.
Saying. Bill Ballinger of the Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter. Bill. Good morning. And we also welcome back Emily Lawler of MERS. Greetings.
Thanks for having me.
Earlier in the month, the Department of Treasury announced a nearly $1 billion budget surplus. The governor made reference to this money in his State of the State. He urged that we avoid thinking only in terms of a tax cut and only in terms of new spending. But he did go on to say that he is open to tax relief, and he went on to make this suggestion.
When I talk about tax relief, the people that come to mind in particular are those hardworking Michiganders that get up every day, they pack their lunch to go to work, they work hard all day, they come home tired, and when after they get home, they're worried about their bills. I don't think we can solve all their issues, but we can help. So when we have this discussion, let's try to stay focused on making sure we're being fiscally responsible, not just for us, but for our children. But let's also work hard to say where it goes, and it should go to those hardworking folk.
Now, there was movement in both the Senate and the House on this front as recently as yesterday. What's been happening?
Well, the governor said just before that, let's not play politics with this, which was, I don't know why he bothered to even put that in the speech. I guess he needed to do that just to keep his wife happy or whatever, because obviously politics is driving this debate. If the governor left to his druthers, he would not be touching any of the surplus to give it back. Do we agree?
I think
agree.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's an election year, but I think that the legislators are the ones looking for this in an election year.
All right, so you have Jack Brandenburg yesterday, Senate Finance Chair, kick out a lowering of the income tax rate stretched out over 4 years. You have the specter of the House Republicans saying, yeah, let's do it, but let's do it a little differently. And the stuff that I'm hearing is that is DOA, because the governor's not going there. And so these guys and ladies can talk about this, but he's going to do $100 million of targeted tax relief at the group that he mentioned in that sound bite with a trigger mechanism that says basically if the economy goes south, we stop what we're doing until we can afford to do it. He will say this in his budget next week, that this is the responsible thing to do. But then in Lansing, when has responsible ever driven this beast?
So how much tension between the legislature and the governor over this?
I think there's tension within chambers even. Jack Brandenburg is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, passed his proposal out yesterday of the committee, and there's question as to, you know, when, if ever, that's going to be taken up on the floor. And then the House version has some sort of trigger involved. There's no trigger in the Senate version. I think there's a lot of different factions trying to figure out how to make this happen.
And now Dems have been calling for a proposal that they talk a lot about, the earned income tax credit, the pension tax. Does any kind of rollback on those fronts have a future here?
Probably not with a Republican-controlled legislature,
right,
and a Republican governor. I think there is tension on this issue, on whether or not to have a tax cut or not, between a Republican-controlled legislature and a Republican governor. That's what makes it interesting and different, obviously, than between, let's say, Jennifer Granholm, a Democrat, if this was a scenario 6 years ago, in a Republican-controlled legislature, because all of these people are running for re-election or election, and for the governor to basically say to his majority Republicans in the House and Senate, forget it, I'm not going to give you this, I'm not going to sign it, that could create some tension within the party, which, as you and I know, is already there.
Is there any kind of, Tim, you alluded to some of the parts of the budget message. What else do we know? We know about early childhood, for example.
Well, we know the education is going to get more money because everybody loves that in an election year, okay? We know that the cities may get a little more. You know what? At the end of the day, it really doesn't matter, okay? They're going to work this thing out, and they'll give areas that need more money, and they'll try to do as much as they can with the surplus and try to get by and hope that it works. It does matter. I don't know why I said that.
Well, it just doesn't matter much because you can't give any of these interests very much.
Right.
Relief or cutting or spending or
$300
whatever.
$300 million in a $14 billion budget is, as the senator said,
yes,
in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And using it to satisfy everybody might end up satisfying nobody.
Precisely.
Right.
Now, a coalition of labor and other rights groups called Raise Michigan has launched an effort to put a minimum wage before state voters in November. Here's Frank Houston of a Michigan restaurant workers group, Rock Michigan, from earlier this week here on Current State.
If you're a family of three and there's one full-time minimum wage worker as you're the primary breadwinner of the family, that family is living in poverty right now. So the idea is by raising the minimum wage even slightly, you know, a couple bucks here we're talking about, this isn't, you know, huge money. That does have a huge impact on families that are struggling to stay above the poverty line.
This issue is heating up. Will Michigan voters be looking at a ballot proposal in November for a higher minimum wage?
If anybody's looking at it, it's going to be Michigan voters. I don't think that the legislature has much interest in taking this up, even though, as I understand, they did kind of preempt a ballot proposal last time this issue came up in 2006.
Okay. Bill?
Yeah, Tim and I remember when we went through this scenario before, back in 2005, 2006. It was interesting to me to note the contrast between the reaction of the Republicans then and today. Then the Republicans were really worried about a ballot proposal getting on the ballot, and they said, we'll hike the minimum wage ourselves here in the legislature, because they were afraid the ballot proposal not only would turn out Democrats, but that it might be a far more severe hike in the tax than the business community and the Republicans wanted. Now I'm hearing, like Emily indicates, kind of deafening silence. The Republicans aren't reacting
yet. Well, I don't think it's completely deafening. When I talked to the Speaker, Jace Bulger, the other day, he did not close the door or open the door, for that matter, to compromising on this issue. But you could make the case that even though the Senate is not competitive, which it was in 2006, the House is. Five seats is maybe a steep climb, but it's doable. And if you drive up that Democratic base to the polls, I think Mr. Bulger is smart enough to know that some of his swing seats could be in jeopardy. So does he talk to the coalition about working out a deal? I don't rule it out. I'm not saying that he said that, but this is early. First of all, they have to demonstrate that they can get the names, and the polling data suggests they can get the votes. And those are two key elements. And if those fall into place, you might find some Republicans at the table saying, well, maybe we can work out a deal.
Hmm.
I think there is going to be some national interest here. We've had
that's really another piece to this whole thing. This has become a really big national debate.
Definitely, and if some of that can parlay into Michigan in terms of dollars and in terms of maybe staff or support or polling, I think that would really help the effort here in the state.
If it makes it to the ballot,
passes.
I think so, too.
Don't even have to.
It looks like it would pass. Okay. All the polls that have been taken 6 years ago and today show it would pass.
Okay. We're hearing a lot of familiar arguments. Is there anything, from Republicans, it's a jobs killer. From Dems, it's overdue and especially appropriate given the unemployment, second highest in the nation here in this state. Has the debate has changed then?
Well, a little bit. Remember also, though, you talk about at the national level, they can't have ballot proposals at the national level. And there's no positive response from John Boehner and the Republicans in the House in Washington to the president's entreaties over let's hike the minimum wage. But here in Michigan, because of what Tim pointed out, the threat of a ballot proposal, That is what would move legislators to say, okay, we're going to have to do something.
And Inside Michigan Politics did some polling on this.
Right. And it showed overwhelming support for a minimum wage hike.
It depends on what the dollar amount is. If you're talking 15, 20 bucks, non-starter. But if you're around 10 bucks, as the president said, 10, I think that's in the neighborhood. This story will drag on, and we'll follow it over the next coming months.
Many election watchers were surprised in January when it was disclosed that the UAW's Bob King approached Senator Whitmer about reconsidering a run for governor. This, of course, some months after the party tried to rally the troops around Mark Schauer. Here's how the senator updated that situation here on Current State shortly thereafter.
I think we all just want to turn the page, frankly. I think Mark has got all the right values. I think he is going to be a strong opponent for the governor, and I'm excited to be supporting him.
Is second guessing of the Schauer candidacy by Democrats over now?
I think so, and I've come to see that as less of a criticism of Mark Schauer and more of a desire for Gretchen Whitmer to run for something. I mean, she's a great candidate. She's been really solid on women's issues, which is a key demographic. And I think that people really wanted to see her try to take the governor's seat.
I think it's over until the Republicans run a commercial that says not even Bob King liked Mark Schauer.
Well, in the event that Governor Snyder is reelected, it would probably kick up some amount of hand-wringing after the fact, right? Shouldn't we have worked harder at another candidate?
For the moment, the story is over. The reason I bring that up is I think the Republicans will use it against them. They'd be silly not to. Here you got the guy who runs the largest labor group in the state asking somebody else to run because, well, why? Because what, Mark Schauer is not any good? It's over for the moment, but I don't think the story is over.
Hmm. Is it known how King's discussion with Senator Whitmer went over with the rank and file? Do we know that?
I think most people are not really paying that much attention to it, even among the insiders and legislators. I tend to disagree with Tim. I think this is a non-story. I don't think it's going to last. I don't think it's going to be probably even used by the Republicans. I don't think people are going to be making up their mind who to vote for in November based on the fact that Bob King met with Gretchen Whitmer back in January about whether or not Schauer should stay in the race or somebody else should get in his stead. I just don't think it's going to be a factor. Mm-hmm. It's a one-week blip because there's nothing else to talk about at that time.
I agree with Bill.
I think going forward, it could, kind of frame the discussion a little bit differently. Is Schauer a second-tier candidate or a second choice? I think that's going to kind of hang over the Democrats' heads for a little bit.
Michigan, we're reviewing January's top Michigan news stories with Tim Skubick of Off the Record, Bill Ballinger of Inside Michigan Politics, and Emily Lawler of MERS News. Michigan will likely become about the 21st state, if memory serves, to call on the federal government to call a constitutional convention to enact a balanced budget amendment with the governor's blessing, which he gave in his State of the State. 34 states would oblige the feds to act. Senator Mike Green on this program suggested it would pass soon. How big of a deal is this?
Well, it'll be a big deal if they hit 34.
It's a long story with Michigan being one more link in the chain.
And there's a huge debate over whether the states that have adopted the correct language. So you're going to be in the courts before you're going to be in the Congress before you get this story done.
Well, if it becomes a constitutional amendment, I mean, one of the biggest counter arguments is that it assigns a great deal more responsibility to the judicial sector here. Since it will become a matter of law, so that is one of the recurring arguments against this thing. The governor has also proposed that $350 million in Michigan tobacco settlement money go to help Detroit over 20 years to pay for city workers' pensions and to assist the Detroit Institute of Arts. What triggered this proposal?
I think that the governor is looking around and saying that these Detroit pensioners don't necessarily live in Detroit. There are people in other districts. There are people who have worked in Detroit but don't live there. And, there's a fundamental unfair feeling to the fact that you've worked all your life, you were promised X amount, and now you're not going to get it because no fault of your own.
I think this may have been triggered by him being called in by a federal judge that says you better do something.
Mm.
Mr. Rosen.
Okay.
Said you've got to do something. And I take the governor at his word that he wants to help Detroit, but you had the prospect this week of the Fitch Credit Rating Agency dumping all over this proposal in a very harshly worded letter from the Wall Street folks, basically saying the governor has ignored the general bondholders, that hallowed group of investors in our country, okay, and picking pensioners over them, an us versus them strategy. Not exactly the kind of thing you want dumped in the legislative hopper when you're trying to sell this to lawmakers, because they will hold up the Fitch letter and say, how can I possibly do this, Governor? Because this could affect our overall state credit rating, even though the letter didn't say that. But it was certainly clearly written in between the lines.
In addition to what Emily and Tim just said, I just point out that the governor, you'll notice, isn't proposing general revenue tax money. He's proposing tobacco settlement money. It's like free money out there that most people thought, isn't that all gone? Didn't we use that up years ago? And he's saying basically, legislature, don't worry. I'm not going to tamper with the general fund. You can still maybe try and get a tax cut bill moving, even though I'm going to veto it. This is free money. So I think the governor is trying to cover his you-know-what to a certain extent because of the federal judge, as Tim just pointed out. I think this is part of his tactic in doing it.
This triggered an interesting series of questions here this week. Who rides herd on the tobacco settlement money? Is that known?
Well, I think it's Treasury, the Department of Treasury.
Yeah, but it's going to the Department of Community Health. It's going to the Strategic Fund and a couple of different areas.
So it's not going to smoking cessation.
Was my next question.
$0 are going to smoking cessation efforts.
Although the state is spending $1.5 million
but
on
that
smoking
money,
cessation.
And that money comes out of the tobacco tax and not the tobacco settlement money.
Very interesting.
And it's not a violation of the agreement because the agreement apparently was written so that they could do whatever they wanted with the money, which is the way the politicians love it.
Now, this was a big controversy 10 years ago about whether this should be using for tobacco cessation.
The new international trade crossing, which we haven't heard too much about in a while, made it back into the news recently. MERS reported the governor's been lobbying the Michigan congressional delegation for support on construction of the Customs Plaza. Break this down for us, Emily.
Right. So there was a big hubbub and celebration when they got the presidential permit for the bridge, and it turns out we need a little more help from our friends in Washington to make this bridge happen. We need a Customs Plaza, and with Ray LaHood, Secretary of Transportation, gone at the federal level, I think that we're having a hard time building support and getting the money for that plaza.
Well, what was driving this story was the quote from Kurt Steidel, the MDOT director, who said, no plaza, no bridge,
right.
Which is, I thought, a pretty good quote. And then I talked to the governor. Of course, he would never want to make news with a good quote, so he wouldn't buy that language. But he conceded the point that when you come off the bridge back into Michigan, you have to go through a plaza, and there has to be one. And the feds are currently sitting on the money, and he's not freed it up, but he's encouraged that the congressional delegation will eventually put the heat on them. Homeland Security apparently is the fly in the ointment here to free up that money. Homeland Security wants Canada for that, too.
That's
not as if Canada hasn't paid for everything. Now they want the plaza as well.
That's the heart of the dispute, is who pays for this thing?
Well, and
right?
You could argue that Canada's sort of suggesting to pay its fair share of the bridge, and now they want, another pound of flesh.
And Maddie money figures into this, too.
Well, you don't know. Yeah, I mean, show
he
me.
He has contributed to Wahlberg's campaign.
Your point.
Candace
Your point.
Miller's point.
What are you saying?
That's more resistance in the legislature.
Well, just because he made campaign contributions doesn't mean he's getting what he wants.
Okay. Not relevant, Emily?
I mean, it may be, but he's got a lot of avenues, not the least of which is legal remedies, so I'm not sure that Congress people are his first resort.
Well, I doubt if he's contributed to the Obama administration, and aren't they the ones that are holding up the plaza right now?
Now, how recently did the governor travel to D.C.? I mean, he lobbied our delegation. Does that officially fall into the month of January? I'm trying to remember.
Well, he was in Washington. I don't know if he lobbied the delegation on that visit last week.
And I know the story in MERS, Emily, referred to the possibility that Mike Duggan may have better inroads to the White House than the governor.
Yeah, I mean, he's a hot new topic and a Democrat in Detroit, so he may have a little bit more sway.
The governor's standing with the White House may have gone down a couple of notches when he signed that, what was that law? Right to work?
Right to something. Freedom?
He may have lost his entree to the West Wing, and that's why Mr. Duggan might be called in, because he can get in there easier.
Are we done hearing about Dave Ajima? Until he posts another bombshell to his Facebook page.
Yeah, you're only done hearing about Dave Ajima for so long, I'm afraid, between Facebook posts. But I think that it'll become, if the Republicans make it an issue, we'll hear about it for longer. If they decide that they want to take some sort of action to change the rules and remove him from office.
Could this become a non-story after a while? Is this going to be forgotten or not? I guess
it's become a non-story before, when Republican spokespeople or officials have made unseemly comments and there's a huge hullabaloo and it blows away. The problem or question is, as Emily was addressing, is he going to shut up? Is he going to stop tweeting? Is he going to stop passing along other people's tweets? The idea of Dave Ajima voluntarily stepping aside, I just don't think it's in his DNA. Have you ever met or talked to him, Mark?
I have not. I've watched videos online.
Yeah, let me know when you do. I want to be there for that conversation.
Okay. What are you suggesting exactly?
I'm suggesting that he's a iconic lone, he looks like he should be chiseled on the back of a silver dollar. And he's arrogant, proud, tall, defiant. He was a former fighter pilot. The idea that he's going to meekly step aside because he's embarrassed a few of his fellow Republicans, it ain't going to happen.
Dave Ajima was the first airline pilot in the country to fly a plane after 9/11. And he could hardly wait to get into the cockpit with his gun.
Exactly. So he's not.
That's quite a story.
Well, it is. He is a very interesting figure. I mean, all the news about him has been negative recently. But the point is, he's not going to back down, and he's not going to meekly bow to Betsy DeVos or Bobby Shostak or Reince Priebus or anybody else.
Okay.
They're going to have to drag him. They're literally going to have to find a maneuver to get him out of office. And if they did, the Republicans realize they've got a huge, ugly, messy battle on their hands internally to replace him, and the backlash from the Tea Party and libertarian types in the Republican Party against the removal of Ajima would be huge within the party, and they want to avoid that at all costs.
He did apologize for the comments regarding the Muslims, that they had not contributed anything to America, but Bill is right. Give this guy credit. He is saying what he believes, and he does have some supporters in the party who say, this is America, you do have the right to free speech, but many of these establishment Republicans look at this as saying, yes, but is this hurting our fundraising efforts, our candidate recruiting, and it goes to the very heart of what we are about, which is winning elections. Does this get in the way of that? And the jury is out on that. But he does have supporters who say, David, right on.
Yeah, this is not, though, what a national committeeman should be doing.
It's not in the job description.
It's not in the job description. Okay. Traditionally, these people in each party have been team players who've raised money. They would never have been the kind of outspoken, brash, First Amendment types that Dave Ajima is.
January's been a pretty busy month. What got lost in the shuffle? Did anything get lost in the shuffle? Anything underreported or overlooked in January?
I've got an unusual one for you. There's some generally accepted agricultural management practices rules that a committee is considering changing at the state level. And basically, small farmers are complaining that this could, as the rules are written now, outlaw like livestock in areas that are zoned residential. So there's a lot of small backyard chicken farmers.
This is the backyard chicken story.
This is the backyard chicken story.
Bill, what are you going to do with yours?
But, you know, I think that this could affect a lot of people if these changes go through.
So. I got nothing on that front.
Okay. Farm bill? Farm Bill particular impact on Michigan here?
Well, it's going to keep the price of milk down where it should be, Mark. I was getting very upset. I'm a big milk drinker, and they were saying that thing was going to go up to $7 or $8 a gallon if we didn't pass a Farm Bill.
Debbie Stabenow is very happy. This has taken her a long time.
Yeah.
And this is probably an example where the process worked. It always took longer than she wanted, but there was a compromise there. They backed off a little bit on the food stamps, so people are going to take a hit, but it wasn't going to be as big as it was. So in the grand scheme of things, this probably was a good piece of legislation.
Yeah, I think what it does, too, is give farmers more certainty in planning financially, and that's always a good thing to agriculture in our state.
What are you all covering today? What are you looking at today?
The recent hunting seasons.
Okay.
Do you know we could have as many as three proposals on a wolf hunt on the ballot in November?
Talk about confusing the voters.
For the first time in history.
To what end?
Whether there should be one or not. We just had one, but remember we had a hunting season on mourning doves 7 years ago,
right.
And then the voters said no more, and that was it. It could happen again.
I'm working on what do we do about the school kids who have been in the snow piles longer than in the classroom. We just had Mike Flanagan on the Off the Record show this week, tomorrow night on all of your public TV stations.
WKARTV.
Yes, there, thank you, Marky. And he said, look it. Tacking on 5 minutes or 30 minutes at the end of the day is, quote, insane. Because you all know, do you remember sitting in school looking at the clock, mm-hmm. waiting for the bell to ring?
Yeah. Right.
Okay, we tack on an extra 5 minutes. There's no learning going on there. Probably not in three. He says we need to tack on 1 day for every day lost over six. So that's what we're working on.
Tim, I have a hard time sitting in school in the summer when it's nice outside.
Well, that is a potential problem. And, of course, Andy Shore, state Democratic representative from Lansing, has a solution. Move up the start of school before Labor Day. Not going to happen.
Whoa.
A lot of kids are in school early in the day to begin with. I mean, the thought of making it longer into the afternoon, I can't process that.
Well,
I know kids.
It is an important issue because obviously this winter the kids have lost a lot of school and they get six freebies. And most people in those districts are there or will be on it, before this is all over.
We want to thank all three of our guests here today for Current State's Month in Review. Tim Skubick, host of Off the Record on Michigan Public Television. Bill Ballinger of the Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter. Emily Lawler of MERS. Many thanks to all of you.
Thanks, Marky.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. When we think about our carbon footprint, if we think about it at all, we often look at things like our car's gas mileage or our home's energy usage or how far our food had to travel to get to the plate. Rarely mentioned in a discussion about carbon footprints, however, are musical instruments. Many traditional musical instruments are made out of wood, and likely the same kind of wood they've been made out of for centuries. And the trees that produce much of that wood are in decline all around the world. One graduate student in the School of Music at Michigan State University decided to do something about his musical carbon footprint. He built his own sustainable instrument made from local materials, but it's not just any old instrument. Current State's Gabriela Saldivia has the story.
That's a marimba. Picture a gigantic xylophone. It has wooden bars of varying lengths and long horizontal tubes underneath called the resonators. The player stands and with two mallets whacks the bars to create the distinct marimba sound. Playing is Alex Smith, a graduate student from North Carolina. Alex came to MSU to study ethnomusicology and percussion performance in 2011. He says he wanted to feel more connected to the instrument he plays every day.
You know, our percussion system, we have a lot of instruments that are made in China and Taiwan and Thailand, or just other international locations. And even if they are made at home, like, we just get them in a box and just have to assemble them.
So he decided to build his own. Alex is not a carpenter and has no formal training and no tools. For help, he found someone who makes custom marimbas less than 90 miles away in Plymouth, Michigan.
It worked out really well. I could be in a place where there isn't a marimba craftsman for states.
Marimbas are typically made from rosewood trees, which are found in different parts of South America, Africa, and India. Alex built his out of Michigan sassafras in just 5 days.
I try to be really aware of what I consume, how I'm consuming it, and, you know, since I'm living here and I'm consuming stuff from Michigan, I think that it's important to support it.
The decline of rosewood trees is a growing issue. Meredith Barrett is an ecologist whose research has focused on rosewood.
It's a really big problem. You know, in Brazil, there has been quite a lot of illegal logging, and it's now protected under CITES Appendix 1. There's also been really problematic logging in India as well.
CITES is the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species. Although rosewood is technically part of the convention, it doesn't seem to be protected from deforestation and logging, mostly because rosewood trees are in pretty high demand.
Because it has this really beautiful, rich burgundy color and very hard wood, it's valued as a prize for very high-end furniture, especially for beautifully carved furniture, as well as for musical instruments.
The fickle musician's ear is one likely reason rosewood trees are in decline. Here's what a rosewood marimba sounds like. And here's a marimba made of Michigan sassafras. That difference you hear, it really matters.
Instruments are by nature a tradition, roots-based thing that people expect their instruments to be what they've always been.
That's Ray Alshire, the purchasing department manager at Elderly Instruments in Lansing.
That is the struggle that the manufacturers deal with, is to keep making instruments from the same woods that are getting more scarce and more expensive.
Though his livelihood depends on the production of musical instruments, Alshire is able to step back and take an environmental approach.
Do we need to stop making guitars? No. But we need to be smart about where the wood comes from, how it's processed to eliminate waste, and that we're doing everything we can to make a great sounding instrument with as little impact on the environment as possible.
As we take a tour of the store, Alshire says Elderly carries other options, like guitars made of sustainable wood certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, which is a governing body that sets criteria for wood to be harvested in an eco-friendly way. But there just aren't many of these guitars on the display floor.
The instruments in general that are Forest Stewardship Council certified are not top sellers.
Awareness of our musical instruments' carbon footprint hasn't quite caught on yet. But it's getting there slowly, says Robert Richardson, MSU professor of sustainability.
The conversation about reducing our carbon footprint is really starting to sort of branch out into every aspect of our lives. So I can't say for sure that there's no work being done on the carbon footprint of musical instruments, but I think the idea is on the minds of many of us.
Last month, the MSU School of Music showcased Alex's work with a recital. About 40 to 50 people showed up, mostly family and friends.
I think there is a small movement, but I think we need to get more people on board with it. I don't think that we can ask everyone in the world or everyone in the percussion community to make their own instrument, but I think we can encourage them to just think about and consider the life that was taken in order to make their instrument.
Alex's Michigan marimba may have been less resonant, but for those in the audience, his message of sustainability was heard loud and clear. For Current State, I'm Gabriela Saldivia.
Most people have at some point in their life shot a basketball. A new book of photography explores the pastime of basketball at its most basic level, the hoop. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Robin Layton, the author of Hoop, The American Dream, and Emmanuel's here to tell us more about the book.
Well, for people who've lived on the edges of rims, this book makes you want to rediscover your childhood hoop. And the baskets that Robin has captured in this book are unique and amazing. So from things like hoops that are underneath highway underpasses to simple things that are just basically rings that have been nailed to trees.
Yeah.
They're all part of this book, including also the hoops of some of the greatest basketball superstars today. So Robin said that she had the idea for this book and that it was born out of a photo exchange with another photographer.
Well, I have a friend who we would send cards to each other as a way to keep in touch about 10 years ago. And one year, he sent me about 5 different basketball pictures, you know, a basketball hoop in front of a car and one that was maybe at a yard sale. And I kept telling him for 10 years, Andy, you have got to do a book. You've got to do calendars. This is a great idea. And he's like, no, I really don't want to. And so for 10 years, I kind of kept nudging him to do it. Well, when I was out in Ohio, I saw a hoop in the snow. And I was just kind of put one foot out of the car and took a picture of it, you know, half in the car, half out. And I thought, uh-oh, I knew right away that I had the hoop bug myself. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, there's no way I can do this. I have to call him right now. Like, right there, I called him, and I said, remember how I've been telling you to do this hoop book for years? And he's like, yeah. And I said, I just took a picture of a hoop in the snow. Are you sure you don't want to do it? He said, nope, why don't you do it? Go for it. You have my blessing. Show me how to do it. So I rented a van, and I had this crazy idea to zigzag across America looking for unique hoops and then the childhood hoops of some of the most revered players of our time.
I'm curious, as I was going through the book, I kept thinking about what your own personal experience is with basketball, that, you know, you'd want to do this. I mean, did you grow up playing?
Everybody asked me that. I played intramurals in school, and I played softball. I was a softball player, but you know, I think it spoke to me, the metaphors in basketball spoke to me not only as a photographer, but as a person. I remember growing up and seeing this poster that really affected me. It was a ball in a gym and the lights coming through the windows of the gym. And the caption under the poster said, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." And I really started thinking about that. And I even saw that before I was a photographer. And it just really spoke to me. Like I said, as a person and a photographer. And also it was a challenge to take a ring, you know, with a backboard sometimes, sometimes not, and to make a different picture out of, you know, I shot over 100,000 images, and about 100 made it to the book. So it was a real challenge to make every photo different. So as a photographer, it was very exciting to do that. And I actually developed hoop eye. I can spot a hoop a mile away. I mean, I can be in the car with some friends, and I'm like, stop, there's a cool one over there. And they're like, how did you see that? It might be a telephone pole with a ring, you know, and watching TV now. I can't even watch a commercial or a TV show without, you know, I'll say to my partner, did you see that hoop? She's like, where? And then we'll back it up. She's like, how do you do that? I said, I guess I've just got hoop eye now, so...
I want to go back real quick. You talked about the challenge of, you know, you're taking pictures of this object, which is the same in a lot of senses. It's always, there's always a ring. It's always a hoop. How did you try and overcome that challenge of making each basket look unique and individual?
You know, I was fortunate enough to be a photojournalist for 5 different papers early in my career. And that training was invaluable. I mean, every day I had to go out in any kind of light, in any situation, and produce high-quality images. I could not come back to the office and go, oh, sorry, I don't have anything. And I think that training was invaluable in this project because, you know, I would wait sometimes when I could because, you know, we're traveling, you know, across the country, so you had to shoot when you could, what you could. You know, you couldn't say, I want to wait for the light when we have to be, you know, at the White House the next day or something. But I think that training and just trying to make something different just came natural to me, you know, because of my background.
A great addition to these stunning photos that you've captured in this book is the stories of players, you know, who've worshipped at the altar of the hoop. You have LeBron James, Shaquille O'Neal, Tamika Catchings, Coach Pat Summitt. All of these thoughts from basketball greats are included. What are some of the stories that stood out the most for you that you collected in the book?
Oh, there's so many. You know, on all of them, I'm so appreciative of the 31 players and coaches that participated. I guess the top two for me would be Doris Rogers. You know, she talks about how she was on the court, and I guess she had a great game, and then the next day she was ranting and raving on the court, acting like she was something, and her dad in the car on the way home said, hey, let me tell you something. You know how you were doing that? If you ever do that again, you'll never play again. He said, when you're good, you don't need to say anything. You don't need to do that. And I thought that was a great lesson for all of us, and you know, and especially kids that are playing now. And then Elgin Baylor's story really touched me about how they, you know, back then they called them the colors, and then they had the white courts, and they weren't allowed to play on the white court, so they had to climb the fence at night. And they couldn't even afford a basketball, and I think they started with a tennis ball and volleyball, and then they could afford a basketball. That story really touched me. So, like I said, there's so many, but if I had to pick two that come to mind, those would be two.
You mentioned the White House earlier. How did you get that shot of the White House basketball hoop?
Well, I'll try to condense this. It's an involved and in-depth story, but I'll try to condense this story. I had four people try to get me into the White House. Four predominant people. I won't mention the first one, but one of the most influential people, a friend of mine that worked for one of the most influential people, and I thought, oh, this will be easy. That didn't work. And then I had was connected to Michelle Obama's photographer. That didn't work. And then I found out a fellow colleague that I worked with at a paper in Virginia worked there as a full-time staff photographer at the White House. And I thought, oh, now I'm in, you know. And then I actually got connected to a senator. Well, all four couldn't get me in. And they all said, we aren't even allowed to walk on that basketball court. Good luck, and, you know, see you later. So I kept trying and trying and trying, and I actually was talking to Tamika Catching's sister, and Taja. Well, Taja called me and said, Tamika had her wisdom teeth out. I'm going to be your go-between because she can't really talk, so what do you need? So we chatted, and at the end of the conversation, I don't know what made me do this, but I said, do you know anybody at the White House? She says, I think I do. Oh, you know what? I'll text you her information when we hang up. So she texts me the information, and I write this woman named Jamie. Well, in the meantime, I've been writing everybody. You know, everybody that I talked to would send me an email, like photo@ whitehouse.gov or something. So I kept calling and emailing, and one day I said to my friend, she was driving the van, I said, you know what? I'm going to take this into my own hands. Give me my phone. She says, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to cold call the White House. So I called, I looked on Google. I got the White House number. And this is how they answer the phone at the White House. White House. I'm like, hi, my name is Robin Layton, and I'm a photographer that lives in Seattle, and I'm going to travel across America photographing unique hoops, blah, blah, blah. You know, did the whole spiel, and I'd like to photograph the White House on basketball hoop. Who do I talk to? He's like, you want to do what? So this went on. I probably called three times a day. I was emailing all the emails that they gave me. I emailed Jamie. Well, one day I get this email. Dear Robin, and this is from Jamie, I've gotten all your phone calls. I've gotten all your emails. Well, I didn't know this, but she was the White House press secretary, right? So all the emails and phone calls were directed to her. This poor woman was bombarded not only with phone calls, but, you know, images I was sending and PDFs of the book. And she's like, there's no way I can authorize this, but, you know, I'll get back to you. I'm like, oh, man, you know, this was my last hope. Well, then, like, 2 hours goes by, and she writes, Dear Robin, capital IF, if we were to do this, how much equipment would you have? And I'm like, uh-oh, we're getting close. And, I wrote back, oh, you know, not much equipment. 2 hours later, Dear Robin, if we were to do this, how many people would be with you, and how much time do you need? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, it's just my assistant and I. 5 seconds, you know, we can do it in 1 second, but 15 minutes would be great. So we drive towards D.C., stop a half hour outside of D.C. I said, Thomas, tell me, she's going to write me back. We check in the hotel, and my friend's unloading the van, and I'm checking in at the desk, and, you know, ladies doing the whole spiel, how many rooms, blah, blah, blah. And I get an email, ding, "Dear Robin, today is your lucky day. Be here at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. You've got 15 minutes. So I run, and I said to the lady, "I'll be right back." So I run outside, and my friend's unloading the car, and I said, "We got in, we got in." And she says, "Is it that great of a hotel?" I said, "No, we got in the White House." She's like, "No way." So we spin each other around, and we couldn't believe it. We called everybody we knew. And I went up to my room, you know, just spinning. I couldn't believe it after months of trying and, you know, trying everything I possibly could. I put my key card on the desk, and I start unpacking, and I look again, and those little cardboard sleeves that go around your plastic, you know, room key, I can't believe it said this, but it says, "The key to your dreams is in your own hands." That was on, and I, you know, there are no coincidences. I have that framed in my office. I mean, it was unbelievable, and we went, and you know, it was just amazing, and it was like the hottest day and the most humid day on the planet. And what an amazing thing that happened. That was just incredible.
You titled the book "Hoop" with the subtitle "The American Dream." How do you think basketball is an illustration of the American dream?
Well, you know what? Hoops are everywhere, and who has not thrown a ball up under the altar? You know, who has not played a game of horse, right? Or at least once. I mean, I bet you if you surveyed America, I bet you probably 99% of America has thrown a basketball up under some kind of hoop, you know. And I think that it just illustrates, you know, look at the people in the book. They all had this dream of becoming a basketball player, and they did, and it took a lot of work and a lot of ethics that they had to do to, you know, you always give your best. Look at Pat Summitt, who the book is actually dedicated to. Who exemplifies a champion more than Pat Summitt? That's why the book is dedicated to her and the Boys and Girls Club as well, because a lot of the players said the Boys and Girls Club changed their life. So I think Hoop the American Dream illustrates not only, you know, persevering your dreams and believing in yourself, but not only for basketball, but for everything. You know, it's across the board, and it's also the only sport in America that we actually have that documentation from. So it's just many, many levels.
Robin Layton is an award-winning photographer. Her book is called Hoop, The American Dream. Robin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
On November 6th of last year, I'm sure you remember it, Michigan State University put out the call to people with MSU ties all over the world to shoot and submit video of whatever they were doing that day. The idea was to produce a video seeing the world through the eyes of Spartans for a day. Now, today, the finished product called MSU 360 goes online, and there will be airings on the Big Ten Network.
Good morning, MSU! How are you feeling today, Spartans?
And I'm currently waiting for my fifth grade students to enter the building.
I'm in Lusaka, Zambia. I'm an MD, PhD student.
Okay, we're here. Where are we?
Gyeongbokgung Palace.
In a couple hours, I'm going to the bank to apply for a loan to buy a house.
And Current State Scott Pohl joins us with more about MSU 360 24. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. This project was interesting. It's basically a collection of very short selfie-type clips sent in from all over the world. I talked with Jim Peck of MSU's Communications and Brand Strategy Office about MSU 360 24.
We had hundreds of clips, and we also had still photos that people sent in, hours and hours of videotape. There actually was no tape sent in. No tape died for the production of this of this television show. I'm amazed at how good some of the stuff looked that came in. I was hoping that it would be compelling, interesting, funny, hopefully touching, speak to the hard work that Spartans are doing everywhere. But I have to admit, I was surprised with the quality of it that came in.
So the finished product is about 30 minutes long.
Yeah, we're going to have a couple of versions. There's a 30-minute version that will be airing on PBS and the Big Ten Network in February. And then we have the half-hour version will go up online. And there's also a short, kind of a trailer-length version that people can watch to get a feel of it. It's very shareable for social media and online and that kind of thing.
Did you have to leave anything out that you felt bad about not being able to include?
A half an hour may not sound like it's that short, but it really is once you get into this. And taking into account that we were trying to give a global feel and include as many corners and parts of the world, which includes a lot of Michigan. I mean, we have all kinds of stuff happening not only in the state of Michigan, but on campus. My goodness, there is just a ton going on. And it got to be a time issue. It got to be a time of day issue. The show is presented chronologically. So when it turns midnight, it turned midnight everywhere in the television program. So we have midnight on campus, midnight in Zambia, 2 o'clock in wherever we are in Hong Kong, in Korea, in Africa. And as we go through the day, you can only fit so much, particularly in between the times of about 9 and 5, as you can imagine, were when we got the vast majority of our content. So it's trying to pick and choose and tell the story as honestly as possible. And also with this, while we are picking and choosing, we're not really editing or over-editing or over-producing this. We're pretty much putting it together organically, the way people sent it into us. And that was one of the really important aspects of this.
Mixed a little music in.
Yeah, put a little music in, partly just to sort of keep people rolling along with the story as it comes. Also to smooth out some of the bumps. Audio is often the trickiest part of doing this stuff, as you know, somebody mm-hmm. who deals mostly in audio. So I think the music helps, but it's hopefully not competing with people or with what people are seeing and hearing.
Now, your team had a major project where you went all over the world to film and tell stories related to MSU's presence all over the globe. This was the second project, I guess you might say. What's next?
The next project we have coming up is actually aligned with the President's Report, again, as was Spartansville 360. And this one is called Inside Out, and it's basically following 9 undergraduate students through their first semester at Michigan State University, first semester of the year, not their first semester. We have freshmen, juniors, seniors, sophomores, and really taking a look inside. So we kind of did far-flung with 360, then we let people show us the world with 24, and now we're going kind of deeper inside to the personal MSU experience of these undergraduate students, and we're in the process of editing that now, so pretty cool.
Where will people find the online version of 360-24?
It'll actually be at msu.edu/24. We had an embarrassment of riches when it came to this, and I have to admit, biggest concern heading into this was that we wouldn't get enough participation, that we would have to sort of rely on the bits and pieces that we got, and it was one of those where you hope it's going to go, and then you start to watch the downloads coming in, and it's like, this is great. Oh, this is really great. Oh, wow, this is really fail. Oh, my, we've got a lot of stuff. And so, but it's been tremendous to put together, and it's just something completely different from what we're used to doing, and I think different from what folks are used to seeing.
Jim Peck is an executive producer at MSU. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll follow up on Lansing's State of the City with Carol Wood and Aylin Bowles of the Lansing City Council. Also, live music from Lansing artist Drew Howard, Friday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. This is 90.5 WKAR.